Moral reforms and deteriorations are moved by large forces, and they are mostly caused by reactions from the habits of a preceding period. Backwards and forwards swings the great pendulum, and its alternations are not determined by a few distinguished folk clinging to the end of it. Sir Charles Petrie, The Victorians. Part the First. By nature, men are nearly alike. By practice, they get to be wide apart. Confucius. A thief visits a mod parlor. Noteworthy features of modern armaments. The bells of St. Mark's were ringing changes up on the mountain when Bud skated over to the mod parlor to upgrade his skull gun. Bud had a nice new pair of blades with a top speed of anywhere from 100 to 150 kilometers, depending on how fat you were and whether or not you wore aero. Bud liked wearing skin-tight leather to show off his muscles. On a previous visit to the mod parlor 2 years ago, he had paid to have a bunch of sights implanted in his muscles. Little critters, too small to see or feel, that twitched Bud's muscle fibers electrically, according to a program that was supposed to maximize bulk. Combined with the testosterone pump embedded in his forearm, it was like working out in a gym night and day, except you didn't have to actually do anything, and you never got sweaty. The only drawback was that all the little twitches made him kind of tense and jerky. He'd gotten used to it, but it still made him a little hinky on those skates, especially when he was doing 100 clicks an hour through a crowded street. But few people hassled Bud, even when he knocked them down in the street, and after today, no one would hassle him ever again. Bud had walked away, improbably unscratched, from his last job, decoy, with something like 1,000 yooks in his pocket. He'd spent a third of it on new clothes, mostly black leather, another third of it on the blades, and was about to spend the last third at the mod parlor. You could get skull guns a lot cheaper, of course, but that would mean going over the causeway to Shanghai and getting a back-alley job from some coaster, and probably a nice bone infection in with the bargain. And he'd probably pick your pocket while he had you theased. Besides, you could only get into a Shanghai if you were virgin. To cross the causeway when you were already packing a skull gun like Bud, you had to bribe the shit out of numerous Shanghai cops. There was no reason to economize here. Bud had a rich and boundless career ahead of him, vaulting up a hierarchy of extremely dangerous drug-related occupations for which decoy served as a paid audition of sorts. A start weapon system was a wise investment. The damn bells kept ringing through the fog. Bud mumbled a command to his music system, a phased acoustical array splayed across both eardrums like the seeds on a strawberry. The volume went up, but couldn't scour away the deep tones of the carillon, which resonated in his long bones. He wondered whether, as long as he was at the mod parlor, he should have the batteries drilled out of his right mastoid and replaced. Supposedly they were 10-year jobs, but he'd had them for 6, and he listened to music all the time, loud. 3 people were waiting. Bud took a seat and skimmed a Mediatron from the coffee table. It looked exactly like a dirty, wrinkled blank sheet of paper. "Annals of Self-Protection," he said, loud enough for everyone else in the place to hear him. The logo of his favorite Mead feed coalesced on the page. Mediaglyphics, mostly the cool animated ones, arranged themselves in a grid. Bud scanned through them until he found the one that denoted a comparison of a bunch of different stuff, and snapped at it with his fingernail. New mediaglyphics appeared, surrounding larger cine panes in which Annals staff tested several models of skull guns against live and dead targets. Bud frisbeed the Mediatron back onto the table. This was the same review he'd been poring over for the last day. They hadn't updated it. His decision was still valid. One of the guys ahead of him got a tattoo, which took about 10 seconds. The other guy just wanted his skull gun reloaded, which didn't take much longer. A girl wanted a few sights replaced in her racting grid, mostly around her eyes where she was starting to wrinkle up. That took a while, so Bud picked up the Mediatron again and went in Arractive, his favorite, called Shut Up or Die. The mod artist wanted to see Bud's yooks before he installed the gun, which in other surroundings might have been construed as an insult, but was standard business practice here in the leased territories. When he was satisfied that this wasn't a stick-up, he theased Bud's forehead with a spray gun, scalped back a flap of skin, and pushed a machine mounted on a delicate robot arm like a dental tool over Bud's forehead. The arm homed in automatically on the old gun, moving with alarming speed and determination. Bud, who was a little jumpy at the best of times because of his muscle stimulators, flinched a little. But the robot arm was 100 times faster than he was and plucked out the old gun unerringly. The proprietor was watching all of this on a screen and had nothing to do except narrate.
"The hole in your skull's kind of rough, so the machine is reaming it out to a larger bore. Okay, now here comes the new gun."
A nasty popping sensation radiated through Bud's skull when the robot arm snapped in the new model. It reminded Bud of the days of his youth, when from time to time one of his playmates would shoot him in the head with a BB gun. He instantly developed a low headache.
"It's loaded with 100 rounds of popcorn," the proprietor said, "so you can test out the uvery. Soon as you're comfortable with it, I'll load it for real."
He stapled the skin of Bud's forehead back together so it'd heal invisibly. You could pay the guy extra to leave a scar there on purpose, so everyone would know you were packing, but Bud had heard that some chicks didn't like it. Bud's relationship with the female sex was governed by a gallimaufry of primal impulses, dim suppositions, deranged theories, overheard scraps of conversation, half-remembered pieces of bad advice, and fragments of, no doubt, exaggerated anecdotes that amounted to rank superstition. In this case, it dictated that he should not request the scar. Besides, he had a nice collection of sights, not very tasteful sunglasses with crosshairs hooded into the lens on your dominant eye. They did wonders for marksmanship, and they were real obvious, too, so that everyone knew you didn't fuck with a man wearing sights.
"Give it a whirl,"
the guy said, and spun the chair around. It was a big old antique barber chair upholstered in swirly plastic, so Bud was facing a mannequin in the corner of the room. The mannequin had no face or hair, and was speckled with little burn marks, as was the wall behind it.
"Status,"
Bud said, and felt the gun buzz lightly in response.
"Stand by,"
he said, and got another answering buzz. He turned his face squarely toward the mannequin. "Hut," he said. He said it under his breath, through unmoving lips, but the gun heard it. He felt a slight recoil tapping his head back, and a startling pop sounded from the mannequin, accompanied by a flash of light on the wall up above its head. Bud's headache deepened, but he didn't care.
"This thing runs faster ammo, so you'll have to get used to aiming a tad lower," said the guy.
So Bud tried it again, and this time popped the mannequin right in the neck.
"Great shot! That would have decapped him if you were using hellfire," the guy said. "Looks to me like you know what you're doing. But there's other options, too, and 3 magazines so you can run multiple ammos."
"I know," Bud said. "I've been checking this thing out." Then to the gun,
"Disperse 10, medium pattern."
Then he said, "Hut," again. His head snapped back much harder, and 10 pops went off at once, all over the mannequin's body and the wall behind it. The room was getting smoky now, starting to smell like burned plastic.
"You can disperse up to 100, the guy said, "but the recoil'd probably break your neck."
"I think I got it down," Bud said.
"So load me up. 1st magazine with electro-stun rounds, 2nd magazine with cripplers, 3rd with hellfires, and get me some fucking aspirin."
Source Victoria. Description of its environs. Source Victoria's air intakes erupted from the summit of the Royal Ecological Conservatory like a spray of 100-meter-long calla lilies. Below, the analogy was perfected by an inverted tree of root-like plumbing that spread fractally through the diamondoid bedrock of New Chuzan, terminating in the warm water of the South China Sea as numberless capillaries arranged in a belt around the smart coral reef several dozen meters beneath the surface. One big huge pipe gulping up seawater would have done roughly the same thing, just as the lilies could have been replaced by one howling maw, birds and litter whacking into a bloody grid somewhere, before they could gum up the works. But it wouldn't have been ecological. The geotechs of Imperial Tectonics would not have known an ecosystem if they'd been living in the middle of one. But they did know that ecosystems were especially tiresome when they got foobarred, so they protected the environment with the same implacable, plodding, green-visored mentality that they applied to designing overpasses and culverts. Thus, water seeped into Source Victoria through microtubes, much the same way it seeped into a beach, and air wafted into it silently down the artfully skewed exponential horns of those thrusting calla lilies, each horn a point in parameter space not awfully far from some central ideal. They were strong enough to withstand typhoons, but flexible enough to rustle in a breeze. Birds, wandering inside, sensed a gradient in the air, pulling them down into night, and simply chose to fly out. They didn't even get scared enough to shit. The lily sprouted from a stadium-sized cut crystal vase, the Diamond Palace, which was open to the public. Tourists, aerobicizing pensioners, and ranks of uniformed schoolchildren marched through it year in and year out, peering through walls of glass, actually solid diamond, which was cheaper, at various phases of the molecular disassembly line that was Source Victoria. Dirty air and dirty water came in and pooled in tanks. Next to each tank was another tank containing slightly cleaner air or cleaner water. Repeat several dozen times. The tanks at the end were filled with perfectly clean nitrogen gas and perfectly clean water. The line of tanks was referred to as a cascade, a rather abstract bit of engineer's whimsy, lost on the tourists who did not see anything snapshot-worthy there. All the action took place in the walls separating the tanks, which were not really walls, but nearly infinite grids of sub-microscopic wheels, ever-rotating and many-spoked. Each spoke grabbed a nitrogen or water molecule on the dirty side and released it after spinning around to the clean side. Things that weren't nitrogen or water didn't get grabbed, hence didn't make it through. There were also wheels for grabbing handy trace elements like carbon, sulfur, and phosphorus. These were passed along smaller, parallel cascades until they were also perfectly pure. The immaculate molecules wound up in reservoirs. Some of them got combined with others to make simple but handy molecular widgets. In the end, all of them were funneled into a bundle of molecular conveyor belts known as the feed, of which Source Victoria and the other half-dozen sources of Atlantis Shanghai were the fountainheads. Financial complications of Bud's lifestyle. Visit to a banker. Bud surprised himself with how long he went before he had to use the skull gun in anger. Just knowing it was in there gave him such an attitude that no one in his right mind would fuck with him, especially when they saw his sights and the black leather. He got his way just by giving people the evil eye. It was time to move up the ladder. He sought work as a lookout. It wasn't easy. The alternative pharmaceuticals industry ran on a start, just-in-time delivery system, keeping inventories low so that there was never much evidence for the cops to seize. The snuff was grown in illicit matter compilers, squirreled away in vacant low-rent housing blocks, and carried by the runners to the actual street dealers. Meanwhile, a cloud of lookouts and decoys circulated probabilistically through the neighborhood, never stopping long enough to be picked up for loitering, monitoring the approach of cops, or cops' surveillance pods, through HUDs in their sunglasses. When Bud told his last boss to go fuck himself, he'd been pretty sure he could get a runner job. But it hadn't panned out, and since then a couple more big airships had come in from North America and disgorged thousands of white and black trash into the job market. Now Bud was running out of money and getting tired of eating the free food from the public matter compilers. The Peacock Bank was a handsome man with a salt-and-pepper goatee, smelling of citrus and wearing an exceedingly snappy double-breasted suit that displayed his narrow waist to good effect. He was to be found in a rather seedy office upstairs of a travel agency in one of the lurid blocks between the aerodrome and the brothel-lined waterfront. The banker didn't say much after they shook hands, just crossed his arms pensively and leaned back against the edge of his desk. In this attitude, he listened to Bud's freshly composed prevarication, nodding from time to time as though Bud had said something significant. This was a little disconcerting, since Bud knew it was all horseshit, but he had heard that these dotheads prided themselves on customer service. At no particular point in the monologue, the banker cut Bud off simply by looking up at him brightly. "You wish to secure a line of credit," he said, as if he were pleasantly surprised, which was not terribly likely.
"I guess you could say that," Bud allowed, wishing he'd known to put it in such fine-sounding terminology.
The banker reached inside his jacket and withdrew a piece of paper, folded in thirds, from his breast pocket.
"You may wish to peruse this brochure," he said to Bud,
and to the brochure itself he rattled off something in an unfamiliar tongue. As Bud took it from the banker's hand, the blank page generated a nice animated color logo in music. The logo developed into a peacock. Beneath it, a video presentation commenced, hosted by a similar-looking gent, sort of Indian-looking, but sort of Arab, too.
"The Parsis welcome you to Peacock Bank," he said.
"What's a Parsi?"
Bud said to the banker, who merely lowered his eyelids one click and jutted his goatee at the piece of paper, which had picked up on his question and already branched into an explanation. Bud ended up regretting having asked, because the answer turned out to be a great deal of general hoo-ha about these Parsis, who evidently wanted to make very sure no one mistook them for dotheads or Pakis or Arabs. Not that they had any problem with those very fine ethnic groups, mind you. As hard as he tried not to pay attention, Bud absorbed more than he wanted to know about the Parsis. Their oddball religion, their tendency to wander around, even their fucking cuisine, which looked weird but made his mouth water anyway. Then the brochure got back to the business at hand, which was lines of credit. Bud had seen this all before. The Peacock Bank was running the same racket as all the others. If they accepted you, they'd shoot the credit card right into you, then and there, on the spot. These guys implanted it in the iliac crest of the pelvis. Some opted for the mastoid bone in the skull. Anywhere a big bone was close to the surface. A bone mount was needed because the card had to talk on the radio, which meant it needed an antenna long enough to hear radio waves. Then you could go around and buy stuff just by asking for it. Peacock Bank and the merchant you were buying from and the card in your pelvis handled all the details. Banks varied in their philosophy of interest rates, minimum monthly payments, and so on. None of that mattered to Bud. What mattered was what they would do to him if he got into arrears. And so after he had allowed a decent interval to pass pretending to listen very carefully to all this crap about interest rates, he inquired, in an off-handed way, like it was an afterthought, about their collection policy. The banker glanced out the window like he hadn't noticed. The soundtrack segued into some kind of a cool jazz number, and a scene of a multicultural crew of ladies and gentlemen, not looking much like degraded credit abusers at all, sitting around a table, assembling chunky pieces of ethnic jewelry by hand. They were having a good time, too, sipping tea and exchanging lively banter. Sipping too much tea, to Bud's suspicious eye, so opaque to so many things, yet so keen to the tactics of media manipulation. They were making rather a big deal out of the tea. He noted with approval that they were wearing normal clothes, not uniforms, and that men and women were allowed to mingle. Peacock Bank supports a global network of clean, safe, and commodious workhouses, so if unforeseen circumstances should befall you during our relationship, or if you should inadvertently anticipate your means, you can rely on being housed close to home while you and the bank resolve any difficulties. Inmates in Peacock Bank workhouses enjoy private beds and, in some cases, private rooms. Naturally, your children can remain with you for the duration of your visit. Working conditions are among the best in the industry, and the high added value content of our folk jewelry operation means that, no matter the extent of your difficulties, your situation will be happily resolved in practically no time.
What's the, strategy for making sure people actually, you know, show up when they're supposed to show up? Bud said.
At this point, the banker lost interest in the proceedings, straightened up, strolled around his desk and sat down, staring out the window across the water toward Pudong and Shanghai.
That detail is not covered in the brochure, he said, as most of our prospective customers do not share your diligent attention to detail insofar as that aspect of the arrangement is concerned.
He exhaled through his nose, like a man eager not to smell something, and adjusted his goatee one time.
The enforcement regime consists of three phases. We have pleasant names for them, of course, but you might think of them respectively as 1. A polite reminder. 2. Well in excess of your pain threshold. 3. Spectacularly fatal.
Bud thought about showing this Parsi the meaning of fatal right then and there, but as a bank, the guy probably had pretty good security. Besides, it was pretty standard policy, and Bud was actually kind of glad the guy had given it to him straight.
Okay, well, I'll get back to you, he said. Mind if I keep the brochure?
The Parsi waved him and the brochure away. Bud took to the streets again, in search of cash on easier terms. A visit from royalty. The Hackworths take an airship holiday. Princess Charlotte's birthday party. Hackworth encounters a member of the peerage. Three geodesic seeds skated over the roofs and gardens of Atlantis, Shanghai, on a Friday afternoon, like the germs of some moon-sized calabash. A pair of mooring masts sprouted and grew from cricket ovals at Source Victoria Park. The smallest of the airships was decorated with the royal ensign. She kept station overhead as the two large ones settled toward their berths. Their envelopes, filled with nothing, were predominantly transparent. Instead of blocking the sunlight, they yellowed and puckered it, projecting vast abstract patterns of brighter and not as bright that the children in their best crinolines and natty short pantsuits tried to catch in their arms. A brass band played. A tiny figure in a white dress stood at the rail of the airship Atlantis, waving at the children below. They all knew that this must be the birthday girl herself, Princess Charlotte, and they cheered and waved back. Fiona Hackworth had been wandering through the Royal Ecological Conservatory, bracketed by her parents, who hoped that in this way they could keep mud and vegetable debris off her skirts. The strategy had not been completely successful, but with a quick brush, John and Gwendolyn were able to transfer most of the dirt onto their white gloves. From there it went straight into the air. Most gentlemen's and ladies' gloves nowadays were constructed of infinitesimal fabricules that knew how to eject dirt. You could thrust your gloved hand into mud, and it would be white a few seconds later. The hierarchy of staterooms on Aether matched the status of its passengers perfectly, as these parts of the ship could be decompiled and remade between voyages. For Lord Finkel McGraw, his three children and their spouses, and Elizabeth, his first and only grandchild so far, the airship lowered a private escalator that carried them up into the suite at the very prow with its nearly 180-degree forward view. Aft of the Finkel McGraws were a dozen or so other equity lords, merely earl or baron level, mostly ushering grandchildren rather than children into the Class B suites. Then it was executives whose gold watch chains adangle with tiny email boxes, phones, torches, snuff boxes, and other fetishes, curved round the dark waistcoats they wore to de-emphasize their bellies. Most of their children had reached the age when they were no longer naturally endearing to anyone save their own parents. The size when their energy was more a menace than a wonder, and the level of intelligence when what would have been called innocence in a smaller child was infuriating rudeness. A honeybee cruising for nectar is pretty despite its implicit threat, but the same behavior in a hornet three times larger makes one glance about for some handy swatting material. So on the broad escalators leading to the first-class staterooms, one could see many upper arms being violently grabbed by hissing fathers with their top hats askew and teeth clenched and eyes swiveling for witnesses. John Percival Hackworth was an engineer. Most engineers were assigned to tiny rooms with fold-down beds, but Hackworth bore the loftier title of Artifex, and had been a team leader on this very project, so he rated a second-class stateroom with one double bed and a fold-out for Fiona. The porter brought their overnight bags around just as Aether was clearing her mooring mast, a 20-meter diamondoid truss that had already dissolved back into the billiard table surface of the oval by the time the ship had turned itself to the south. Lying as close as it did to Source Victoria, the park was riddled with catechthonic feed lines, and anything could be grown there on short notice. The Hackworth stateroom was to starboard, and so as they accelerated away from New Chuzan, they got to watch the sun set on Shanghai, shining redly through the city's eternal cloak of coal smoke. Gwendolyn read Fiona's stories in bed for an hour while John perused the evening edition of the Times, then spread out some papers on the room's tiny desk. Later, they both changed into their evening clothes, primping quietly in twilight so as not to wake Fiona. At 9 o'clock, they stepped into the passageway, locked the door, and followed the sound of the big band to Aether's grand ballroom, where the dancing was just getting underway. The floor of the ballroom was a slab of transpicuous diamond. The lights were low. They seemed to float above the glittering moonlit surface of the Pacific as they did the waltz, minuet, Lindy, and electric slide into the night. Sunrise found the three airships hovering over the South China Sea, no land visible. The ocean was relatively shallow here, but only Hackworth and a few other engineers knew that. The Hackworths had a passable view from their stateroom window, but John woke up early and staked out a place on the diamond floor of the ballroom, ordered an espresso and a Times from a waiter, and passed the time pleasantly while Gwen and Fiona got themselves ready for the day. All around them he could hear children speculating on what was about to happen. Gwen and Fiona arrived just late enough to make it interesting for John, who took his mechanical pocket watch out at least a dozen times as he waited, and finally ended up clutching it in one hand, nervously popping the lid open and shut. Gwen folded her long legs and spread her skirts out prettily on the transparent floor, drawing vituperative looks from several women who remained standing. But John was relieved to see that most of these women were relatively low-ranking engineers or their wives. None of the higher-ups needed to come to the ballroom. Fiona collapsed to her hands and knees and practically shoved her face against the diamond, her fundament aloft. Hackworth gripped the creases of his trousers, hitched them up just a bit, and sank to one knee. The smart coral burst out of the depths with violence that shocked Hackworth, even though he'd been in on the design, seen the trial runs. Viewed through the dark surface of the Pacific, it was like watching an explosion through a pane of shattered glass. It reminded him of pouring a jet of heavy cream into coffee, watching it rebound from the bottom of the cup in a turbulent, fractal bloom that solidified just as it dashed against the surface. The speed of this process was a carefully planned sleight of hand. The smart coral had actually been growing down on the bottom of the ocean for the last 3 months, drawing its energy from a supercon that they'd grown across the seafloor for the occasion, extracting the necessary atoms directly from the seawater and the gases dissolved therein. The process happening below looked chaotic, and in a way it was, but each lithocule knew exactly where it was supposed to go and what it was supposed to do. They were tetrahedral building blocks of calcium and carbon, the size of poppy seeds, each equipped with a power source, a brain, and a navigational system. They rose from the bottom of the sea at a signal given by Princess Charlotte. She had awakened to find a small present under her pillow, unwrapped it to find a golden whistle on a chain, stood out on her balcony, and blown the whistle. The coral was converging on the site of the island from all directions, some of the lithocules traveling several kilometers to reach their assigned positions. They displaced a volume of water equal to the island itself, several cubic kilometers in all. The result was furious turbulence, an upswelling in the surface of the ocean that made some of the children scream, thinking it might rise up and snatch the airship out of the sky. And indeed, a few drops pelted the ship's diamond belly, prompting the pilot to give her a little more altitude. The curt maneuver forced hearty laughter from all of the fathers in the ballroom, who were delighted by the illusion of danger and the impotence of nature. The foam and mist cleared away at some length to reveal a new island, salmon-colored in the light of dawn. Applause and cheers diminished to a professional murmur. The chattering of the astonished children was too loud and high to hear. It would be a couple of hours yet. Hackworth snapped his fingers for a waiter and ordered fresh fruit, juice, Belgian waffles, more coffee. They might as well enjoy Ether's famous cuisine while the island sprouted castles, fauns, centaurs, and enchanted forests. Princess Charlotte was the first human to set foot on the Enchanted Isle, tripping down the gangway of Atlantis with a couple of her little friends in tow, all of them looking like tiny wildflowers in their ribbon sunbonnets, all carrying little baskets for souvenirs, though before long these were handed over to governesses. The princess faced Ether and Chinook, moored a couple of hundred meters away, and spoke to them in a normal tone of voice that was, however, heard clearly by all. A nanophone was hidden somewhere in the lace collar of her pinafore, tied into phased audio array systems grown into the top layers of the island itself. "I would like to express my gratitude to Lord Finkel McGraw and all the employees of Machine Phase Systems Limited for this most wonderful birthday present. Now, children of Atlantis Shanghai, won't you please join me at my birthday party?" The children of Atlantis Shanghai all screamed yes and rampaged down the multifarious gangways of Ether and Chinook, which had all been splayed out for the occasion in hopes of preventing bottlenecks, which might lead to injury or, heaven forbid, rudeness. For the first few moments, the children simply burst away from the airships like gas escaping from a bottle. Then they began to converge on sources of wonderment. A centaur, 8 feet high if he was an inch, walking across a meadow with his son and daughter cantering around him. Some baby dinosaurs. A cave angling gently into a hillside, bearing promising signs of enchantment. A road winding up another hill toward a ruined castle. The grown-ups mostly remained aboard the airships and gave the children a few minutes to flame out, though Lord Finkel McGraw could be seen making his way toward Atlantis, poking curiously at the earth with his walking stick, just to make sure it was fit to be trod by royal feet. A man and a woman descended the gangway of Atlantis. In a floral dress that explored the labile frontier between modesty and summer comfort, accessorized with a matching parasol, Queen Victoria II of Atlantis. In a natty beige linen suit, her husband, the prince consort, whose name, lamentably, was Joe. Joe, or Joseph as he was called in official circumstances, stepped down first, moving in a somewhat pompous one-small-step-for-man gait, then turned to face Her Majesty and offered his hand, which she accepted graciously but perfunctorily, as if to remind everyone that she'd done crew at Oxford and had blown off tension during her studies at Stanford B School with lap swimming, rollerblading, and Jeet Kune Do. Lord Finkel McGraw bowed as the Royal Espadrilles touched down. She extended her hand, and he kissed it, which was racy, but allowed if you were old and stylish, like Alexander Chung Sik Finkel McGraw. "We thank Lord Finkel McGraw, Imperial Tectonics Limited, and Machine Phase Systems Limited once again for this lovely occasion. Now let us all enjoy these magnificent surroundings before, like the first Atlantis, they sink forever beneath the waves." The parents of Atlantis Shanghai strolled down the gangways, though many had retreated to their staterooms to change clothes upon catching sight of what the Queen and Prince Consort were wearing. The big news, already being uploaded to the Times by telescope-wielding fashion columnists on board Ether, was that the parasol was back. Gwendolyn Hackworth hadn't packed a parasol, but she was untroubled. She'd always had a kind of natural, unconscious alimodality. She and John strolled down onto the island. By the time Hackworth's eyes had adjusted to the sunlight, he was already squatting and rubbing a pinch of soil between his fingertips. Gwen left him to obsess and joined a group of other women, mostly engineers' wives, and even a baronet-level equity participant or two. Hackworth found a concealed path that wound through trees up a hillside to a little grove around a cool, clear pond of fresh water. He tasted it just to be sure. He stood there for a while, looking out over the enchanted island, wondering what Fiona was up to right now. This led to daydreaming. Perhaps she had, by some miracle, encountered Princess Charlotte, made friends with her, and was exploring some wonder with her right now. This led him into a long reverie that was interrupted when he realized that someone was quoting poetry to him.
"Where had we been, we two, beloved friend? If in the season of unperilous choice, in lieu of wandering as we did through vales rich with indigenous produce, open ground of fancy, happy pastures ranged at will, we had been followed, hourly watched and noosed, each in his several melancholy walk, stringed like a poor man's heifer at its feed, led through the lanes in forlorn servitude."
Hackworth turned to see that an older man was sharing his view. Genetically Asian, with a somewhat twangy North American accent, the man looked at least 70. His translucent skin was still stretched tight over broad cheekbones, but the eyelids, ears, and the hollows of his cheeks were weathered and wrinkled. Under his pith helmet, no fringe of hair showed. The man was completely bald. Hackworth gathered these clues slowly until at last he realized who stood before him.
"Sounds like Wordsworth," Hackworth said.
The man had been staring out over the meadows below. He cocked his head and looked directly at Hackworth for the first time.
"The poem?"
"Judging by content, I'd guess the prelude."
"Nicely done," the man said.
"John Percival Hackworth at your service."
Hackworth stepped toward the other and handed him a card.
"Pleasure," the man said.
He did not waste breath introducing himself. Lord Alexander Chung Sik Finkel McGraw was one of several Duke-level equity lords who had come out of Apthorpe. Apthorpe was not a formal organization that could be looked up in a phone book. In financial cant, it referred to a strategic alliance of several immense companies, including Machine Phase Systems Limited and Imperial Tectonics Limited. When no one important was listening, its employees called it John Zaibatsu, much as their forebears of a previous century had referred to the East India Company as John Company. MPS made consumer goods, and ITL made real estate, which was, as ever, where the real money was. Counted by the hectare, it didn't amount to much, just a few strategically placed islands, really, counties rather than continents. But it was the most expensive real estate in the world, outside of a few blessed places like Tokyo, San Francisco, and Manhattan. The reason was that Imperial Tectonics had geotechs, and geotechs could make sure that every new piece of land possessed the charms of Frisco, the strategic location of Manhattan, the feng shui of Hong Kong, and the dreary but obligatory Lebensraum of L.A. It was no longer necessary to send out dirty yokels in coonskin caps to chart the wilderness, kill the abos, and clear-cut the groves. Now all you needed was a hot young geotech, a start matter compiler, and a jumbo source. Like most other Neo-Victorians, Hackworth could recite Finkel McGraw's biography from memory. The future Duke had been born in Korea and adopted at the age of 6 months by a couple who'd met during grad school in Iowa City and later started an organic farm near the Iowa-South Dakota border. During his early teens, a passenger jet made an improbable crash landing at the Sioux City airport, and Finkel McGraw, along with several other members of his Boy Scout troop, who had been hastily mobilized by their scoutmaster, was standing by the runway along with every ambulance, fireman, doctor, and nurse from a radius of several counties. The uncanny efficiency with which the locals responded to the crash was widely publicized and became the subject of a made-for-TV movie. Finkel McGraw couldn't understand why. They'd simply done what was reasonable and humane under the circumstances. Why did people from other parts of the country find this so difficult to understand? This tenuous grasp of American culture might have been owing to the fact that his parents homeschooled him up to the age of 14. A typical school day for Finkel McGraw consisted of walking down to a river to study tadpoles or going to the public library to check out a book on ancient Greece or Rome. The family had little spare money, and vacations consisted of driving to the Rockies for some backpacking or up to northern Minnesota for canoeing. He probably learned more on his summer vacations than most of his peers did during their school years. Social contact with other children happened mostly through Boy Scouts or church. The Finkel McGraws belonged to a Methodist church, a Roman Catholic church, and a tiny synagogue that met in a rented room in Sioux City. His parents enrolled him in a public high school, where he maintained a steady 2.0 average out of a possible 4. The coursework was so stunningly inane, the other children so dull, that Finkel McGraw developed a poor attitude. He earned some repute as a wrestler and a cross-country runner, but never exploited it for sexual favors, which would have been easy enough in the promiscuous climate of the times. He had some measure of the infuriating trait that causes a young man to be a nonconformist for its own sake, and found that the surest way to shock most people in those days was to believe that some kinds of behavior were bad and others good, and that it was reasonable to live one's life accordingly. After graduating from high school, he spent a year running certain parts of his parents' agricultural business and then attended Iowa State University of Science and Technology, Science with Practice, in Ames. He enrolled as an agricultural engineering major and switched to physics after his first quarter. While remaining a nominal physics major for the next 3 years, he took classes in whatever he wanted, information science, metallurgy, early music. He never earned a degree. Not because of poor performance, but because of the political climate. Like many universities at the time, ISU insisted that its students study a broad range of subjects, including arts and humanities. Finkel McGraw chose instead to read books, listen to music, and attend plays in his spare time. One summer, as he was living in Ames and working as a research assistant in a solid-state physics lab, the city was actually turned into an island for a couple of days by an immense flood. Along with many other Midwesterners, Finkel McGraw put in a few weeks building levees out of sandbags and plastic sheeting. Once again, he was struck by the national media coverage. Reporters from the coasts kept showing up and announcing, with some bewilderment, that there had been no looting. The lesson learned during the Sioux City plane crash was reinforced. The Los Angeles riots of the previous year provided a vivid counterexample. Finkel McGraw began to develop an opinion that was to shape his political views in later years. Namely, that while people were not genetically different, they were culturally as different as they could possibly be, and that some cultures were simply better than others. This was not a subjective value judgment, merely an observation that some cultures thrived and expanded while others failed. It was a view implicitly shared by nearly everyone, but in those days, never voiced. Finkel McGraw left the university without a diploma and went back to the farm, which he managed for a few years while his parents were preoccupied with his mother's breast cancer. After her death, he moved to Minneapolis and took a job with a company founded by one of his former professors, making scanning tunneling microscopes, which at the time were newish devices capable of seeing and manipulating individual atoms. The field was an obscure one then. The clients tended to be large research institutions, and practical applications seemed far away. But it was perfect for a man who wanted to study nanotechnology. And McGraw began doing so, working late at night on his own time. Given his diligence, his self-confidence, his intelligence,
adaptable, relentless, but not really brilliant,
and the basic grasp of business he'd picked up on the farm, it was inevitable that he would become one of the few hundred pioneers of nanotechnological revolution. That his own company, which he founded 5 years after he moved to Minneapolis, would survive long enough to be absorbed into Apthorpe, and that he would navigate Apthorpe's political and economic currents well enough to develop a decent equity position. He still owned the family farm in northwestern Iowa, along with a few 100,000 acres of adjoining land, which he was turning back into a tall grass prairie, complete with herds of bison and real Indians, who had discovered that riding around on horses hunting wild game was a better deal than pissing yourself in gutters in Minneapolis or Seattle. But for the most part, he stayed on New Chusan, which was, for all practical purposes, his ducal estate.
"Public relations?" said Finkel McGraw.
"Sir?"
Modern etiquette was streamlined. No "Your Grace" or other honorifics were necessary in such an informal setting.
"Your department, sir."
Hackworth had given him his social card, which was appropriate under these circumstances, but revealed nothing else.
"Engineering. Bespoke."
"Oh, really? I thought anyone who could recognize Wordsworth must be one of those artsy sorts in PR."
"Not in this case, sir. I'm an engineer. Just promoted to bespoke recently. Did some work on this project, as it happens."
"What sort of work?"
"Oh, PI stuff, mostly," Hackworth said.
Supposedly, Finkel McGraw still kept up with things and would recognize the abbreviation for pseudo-intelligence, and perhaps even appreciate that Hackworth had made this assumption. Finkel McGraw brightened a bit.
"You know, when I was a lad, they called it AI, artificial intelligence."
Hackworth allowed himself a tight, narrow, and brief smile.
"Well, there's something to be said for cheekiness, I suppose."
"In what way was pseudo-intelligence used here?"
"Strictly on MPS's side of the project, sir."
Imperial Tectonics had done the island, buildings, and vegetation. Machine Phase Systems, Hackworth's employer, did anything that moved.
"Stereotype behaviors were fine for the birds, dinosaurs, and so on, but for the centaurs and fauns we wanted more interactivity, something that would provide an illusion of sentience."
"Yes. Well done. Well done, Mr. Hackworth."
"Thank you, sir."
"Now, I know perfectly well that only the very finest engineers make it to bespoke. Suppose you tell me how an aficionado of romantic poets made it into such a position."
Hackworth was taken aback by this and tried to respond without seeming to put on airs.
"Surely a man in your position does not see any contradiction."
"But a man in my position was not responsible for promoting you to bespoke. A man in an entirely different position was. And I am very much afraid that such men do tend to see a contradiction."
"Yes, I see. Well, sir, I studied English literature in college," Hackworth said.
"Ah, so you are not one of those who followed the straight and narrow path to engineering?"
"I suppose not, sir."
"And your colleagues at bespoke?"
"Well, if I understand your question, sir, I would say that, as compared with other departments, a relatively large proportion of bespoke engineers have had, well, for lack of a better way of describing it, interesting lives."
"And what makes one man's life more interesting than another's?"
"In general, I should say that we find unpredictable or novel things more interesting."
"That is nearly a tautology."
But while Lord Finkel McGraw was not the sort to express feelings promiscuously, he gave the appearance of being nearly satisfied with the way the conversation was going. He turned back toward the view again and watched the children for a minute or so, twisting the point of his walking stick into the ground as if he were still skeptical of the island's integrity. Then he swept the stick around in an arc that encompassed half the island.
"How many of those children do you suppose are destined to lead interesting lives?"
"Well, at least 2, sir, Princess Charlotte and your granddaughter."
"You're quick, Hackworth, and I suspect capable of being devious if not for your staunch moral character,"
Finkel McGraw said, not without a certain archness.
"Tell me, were your parents subjects, or did you take the oath?"
"As soon as I turned 21, sir, Her Majesty, at that time actually she was still Her Royal Highness, was touring North America prior to her enrollment at Stanford, and I took the oath at Trinity Church in Boston."
"Why, you're a clever fellow, not blind to culture like so many engineers. You could have joined the First Distributed Republic, or any of 100 synthetic files on the West Coast. You would have had decent prospects and been free from all this
Finkel McGraw jabbed his cane at the two big airships. Behavioral discipline that we impose upon ourselves. Why did you impose it on yourself, Mr. Hackworth?
Without straying into matters that are strictly personal in nature, Hackworth said carefully, I knew two kinds of discipline as a child. None at all, and too much. The former leads to degenerate behavior. When I speak of degeneracy, I am not being priggish, sir. I'm alluding to things well known to me, as they made my own childhood less than idyllic.
Finkel McGraw, perhaps realizing that he had stepped out of bounds, nodded vigorously. This is a familiar argument, of course.
Of course, sir. I would not presume to imply that I was the only young person ill-used by what became of my native culture.
And I do not see such an implication. But many who feel as you do found their way into files wherein a much harsher regime prevails, and which view us as degenerates.
My life was not without periods of excessive, unreasoning discipline, usually imposed capriciously by those responsible for laxity in the first place. That, combined with my historical studies, led me, as many others, to the conclusion that there was little in the previous century worthy of emulation, and that we must look to the 19th century instead for stable social models.
Well done, Hackworth. But you must know that the model to which you allude did not long survive the first Victoria.
We have outgrown much of the ignorance and resolved many of the internal contradictions that characterized that era.
Have we, then? How reassuring. And have we resolved them in a way that will ensure that all of those children down there live interesting lives?
I must confess that I am too slow to follow you.
You yourself said that the engineers in the bespoke department, the very best, had led interesting lives, rather than coming from the straight and narrow, which implies a correlation, does it not?
Clearly.
This implies, does it not, that in order to raise a generation of children who can reach their full potential, we must find a way to make their lives interesting. And the question I have for you, Mr. Hackworth, is this. Do you think that our schools accomplish that? Or are they like the schools that Wordsworth complained of?
My daughter is too young to attend school, but I should fear that the latter situation prevails.
I assure you that it does, Mr. Hackworth. My three children were raised in those schools, and I know them well. I am determined that Elizabeth shall be raised differently.
Hackworth felt his face flushing. Sir, may I remind you that we have just met? I do not feel worthy of the confidences you are reposing in me.
I'm telling you these things not as a friend, Mr. Hackworth, but as a professional.
Then I must remind you that I am an engineer, not a child psychologist.
This I have not forgotten, Mr. Hackworth. You are indeed an engineer, and a very fine one, in a company that I still think of as mine, though as an equity lord I no longer have a formal connection. And now that you have brought your part of this project to a successful conclusion, I intend to put you in charge of a new project for which I have reason to believe you are perfectly suited.